This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Neda Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage, from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between.
And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
comedian Patton Oswalt and writer and director Robert Siegel talk with Fresh Air's Terry Gross about their upcoming film, Big Fan. And Archie. The redheaded heartthrob of Archie Comics fame finally decides to settle down with one of the two-dimensional women in his life. Linda will say why this is much ado about nothing. But first,
writer and director Quentin Tarantino has said his new movie, Inglourious Basterds, is not your daddy's World War II picture. In the film, a squad of Jewish-American soldiers is set loose to cause havoc in German-occupied France. The film quickly takes you into a parallel universe of outrageous violence and a plot to kill Hitler himself. Tarantino spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep about the origins of the characters and his darkly comedic dialogue.
It's just kind of the way I write. You know, there is a comedy aspect to everything that I've ever done. You know, I stop short of calling them comedies because there's actually serious stuff in the films.
You stop short of calling them comedies because people are being scalped and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, little things like that, all right? But that doesn't mean we can't have a good time. All right. But the humor comes out of it. It comes out of just the way I do things. But also part of my method of doing stuff is to make people laugh at stuff that's not normally funny.
I want to play a little clip from this movie. What we're going to hear here is Brad Pitt, and he is confronted by a German army officer who is known for hunting down Jews.
Yes.
So you're the Jew hunter.
I'm a detective. A damn good detective. Finding people is my specialty, so naturally I worked for the Nazis finding people, and yes, some of them were Jews, but Jew hunter? Just a name that stuck.
Well, you do have to admit, it is catchy.
Do you control the nicknames your enemies bestow on you? Aldo the Apache and the Little Man?
The German's nickname for me is the Little Man.
And as if to make my point, I'm a little surprised how tall you were in real life when you were a little fellow, but not circus midget little.
And we also hear, of course, one of Brad Pitt's soldiers there as well.
Yeah, B.J. Novak. Actually, that's my first radio clip I've ever heard. Yeah, but not every director gets a radio clip. They don't talk that often, all right? So
well, you've got a lot of dialogue.
I got a lot of dialogue.
which is what I want to ask about, because there are extraordinarily long scenes of dialogue that are incredibly tense throughout this movie. Your movies may be known for violence, but they're also known for the dialogue. And I'd like to know, as best you can describe it, how you go about writing a scene like that. Do you practice lines on people? Do you just sit alone and it comes out of your head? What happens?
Yeah, it's the sitting alone coming out of my head scenario that's the closest. I mean, basically, I just get the characters talking to each other. And then they do it. They really write the scene. I'm more like a court reporter. Jotting it down, all right? The whole trick is to get them talking to each other. And then when I'm done writing the scene, then Quentin, the writer, comes in and just kind of cleans it up just a little bit.
It's hard to escape the notion that you're commenting in many ways on movies in this movie, particularly since, and we don't want to give away the ending here, but it involves a scene in a movie theater, let's say that much.
Yeah, for sure.
And you also have said this isn't your daddy's World War II movie. what were you thinking about when you said that?
Well, that comment, there's been certain contrivances, especially when it comes to language, where people are supposed to be speaking German, but it's standing in for, they're speaking English and it's supposed to be German.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a contrivance that we've put up with for a long time. And I think that day is over. I actually think it makes, movies take place in Nazi Germany and they're all speaking English, or in particular, almost Shakespearean English. All right. It's like you would think the Third Reich started at the Old Vic. all these Shakespearean actors walking through the door. I think it makes them quaint.
Well, that's really interesting, because I don't think anybody would say this is precisely a realistic war movie. The history certainly doesn't turn out as it did in the history books. But the realism was important to you in some other ways, it sounds like.
Oh, no, completely, actually. And there is an aspect that this movie, one of the things it's about is about language. And that was such a big, big deal in World War II. I mean, people died and were shot and thrown in ditches because they couldn't understand a German order. And also you have to remember something else that I think was very fascinating. World War II is the last time that a whole bunch of white people fought another whole bunch of white people. And consequently, if you could pull off language, you could infiltrate somebody else's army, whether it's the Germans infiltrating the Polish underground or the Czech underground, or whether it's, you know, us trying to infiltrate the Germans. But in like something like, say, Where Eagles Dare. Actually.
Which movie is that?
Where Eagles Dare with Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood. And that's a very fun movie. But in that movie, there's a section that apparently Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood speak German so beautifully, so absolutely flawlessly, that all they have to do is put on a German uniform and, you know, mix it up with the hoi polloi of the German high command in some tavern. Now, the fact that English is standing in for German, all right, there does two things. One, I don't buy it. But yeah, also, the suspense is completely gone.
Here's a suspenseful movie question. Is it any good? Scott Tobias is film editor for the AV Club and the satirical newspaper The Onion. He wrote a review on NPR.org about Inglourious Basterds.
We have Scott Tobias on the line. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just fine. We thought we would talk to you a little bit about this movie. You know, you started off the review talking about a critical question about Quentin Tarantino films that
yes.
comes up over and over again. Why don't you explain that to us?
Well, I think the question is, you know, when will Quentin Tarantino grow up? You know, here is a filmmaker who is sort of a once-in-a-generation talent, but he doesn't really fit into the mold of some austere grandmaster. He's not Ho Chau Shen. He's not Jacques Rivette. He's somebody who is into, you know, B-movies and drive-in fare and spaghetti westerns and martial arts movies and things that, for lack of a better term, are sort of, you know, cinematic trash.
Yeah, you know, I was going to ask you about your mixed feelings. And, you know, obviously Quentin Tarantino is somebody who has a lot of very passionate enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And what kind of reaction, what sort of happens when you decide to be the guy who's maybe a little bit of a doubter on a movie that obviously opened very strong, a lot of people really like?
I do definitely feel lonely not being behind this movie, because I am a fan. But this movie, it's a little off. It's a little shapeless, indulgent, and kind of lacking discipline.
Thank you, Scott.
All right.
We'll hear next from another Onionite? Onioner? A former Onion editor, Robert Siegel, who's no relation to our venerable All Things Considered host. This Robert Siegel left The Onion and went on to write the screenplay for the film The Wrestler. Now he's written and directed a new movie called Big Fan. It stars comic Patton Oswalt as an obsessive fan who regularly calls in to his favorite sports talk radio station.
Hey, Paul from Staten Island.
Hey.
What we got tonight?
Hey, what's up, dog? I gotta tell you, I am feeling good tonight because in a little less than 48 hours, we are gonna brutally shatter any flicker of hope the Cheesesteaks had going. We've been messing with them the last few weeks, letting them get back in it a little, making them think they had a chance of catching us, just so we can see the look on their faces when they come up short. Quantrell's back, baby,
Whoa.
And he is good. Quantrell is back, baby, and he is ready to make up for some lost time against the Panthers. You better hope the scoreboard is broken down there in St. Louis, because the Eagles are going to be so crushed when they look up at it and see the Giants-Panthers score, they're not even going to be able to play. It's not even going to come down to the head-to-head in Week 17. We're going to wrap up the East in a nice little bow this coming... Sorry.
Oswalt and Siegel talked about the project to Terry Gross on WHYY's Fresh Air.
What did you think of Patton Oswalt for the role of the fan?
Why did I think of him?
Yeah, I mean, he's best known as a comic and as an actor in comedies. This is not a comic film. It's not a comic performance.
No. I didn't do it, and, you know, sometimes comedians are cast in dramatic roles in ways that feel like stunt casting. You know, look at the funny clown. He's really sad inside. I just thought he was right. I just thought he really felt right for the role. He looked right. He was the right age.
What does looking right mean?
Yeah, what does looking right mean, Robert?
Can I let Patton take
it? No, you can't.
You know, I thought if he... we discussed it, and he said he was willing to bulk up for the role and stay out of the sun. He had a pretty healthy, glowing tan at the time, and he promised that he would go method and stay in his basement for a few months to kind of get rid of that.
Yeah, I laid off the mixed martial arts for about 9 months
so,
and really got doughy. So.
I thought if he would go through a very advanced, aggressive anti-tanning process and then... hit some Lucky Charms. we could get him into shape. No, I just thought, Patton, may I insult you?
Go right ahead.
Okay. I just thought he looked like he could be a an obsessive, nerdy sports fan. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. And I also thought, honestly, on a practical level, it was a very low budget movie, and I didn't think that Philip Seymour Hoffman or Paul Giamatti would be willing to. I'd be getting reamed out by their managers every night when they found out that I didn't supply them with a chair to sit in, things like that. So I knew I couldn't get those two guys.
And plus, Paul Giamatti is a triathlete. He wears that schlubby suit. That's a fake thing he puts on for his roles. Yeah, that guy has, I think he's at 2% body fat right now. He's so cut. So he puts on this Paul Giamatti suit, and that's why he gets all this indie cred. And it drives me crazy.
Patton Oswalt, now that we know that you come cheap.
I come cheap?
Not
come
anymore. Cheap. We eat this.
Thanks for jumping in, Robert.
That will change now.
Yeah. Your performance is really terrific in the film. I mean, you really capture the kind of the loneliness and frustration and disconnection and kind of anger and niceness of this character. What did you think about the role when you were offered it? Did you say, yeah, that's perfect for me? Was that your first reaction or was it something else?
Well, when I read the script itself, I loved how it was written, that style of writing, which, because I'm such a film buff and love all those movies from the early 70s, those sort of difficult character studies. Do you know what I mean? Stuff like Fat City and King of Marvin Gardens and I really miss that kind of writing and filmmaking. So there was this – I had mixed feelings because on the one hand, this is a very dark – very, very messed up character, but as a guy who loves watching movies, this was the kind of movie that I'd always dreamed of being in at one point in my career. After a very short consideration, I had to say yes.
You can hear the rest of this interview, and we know you want to, at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
Well, you know, Patton Oswalt is one kind of comic. A different kind of comic is the Archie comic. One of the world's great love triangles will finally, apparently, resolve itself after almost 70 years. The eternal teenager Archie Andrews of Archie Comics fame has finally chosen a bride, and in issue 600, he picks the dark-haired Veronica. NPR's Nina Gregory has the story.
Our unlikely hero is an awkward but polite 17-year-old redhead. He somehow manages to hold the attention of both Betty, the girl next door, and Veronica, the raven-haired rich girl. Archie is distinctly average. He's middle class, works part-time, plays in a band, and is not quite athletic enough to make the team. Victor Gorelick has worked at Archie Comics for over 50 years and is Archie's editor-in-chief. He explains the Archie mystique.
He's not a Superman. He's not a Batman. He doesn't have all these powers. He's just the power of being able to have people like him.
And it's not just Betty and Veronica who like Archie. Generations of readers have been drawn to these stories. Comic book store owner Joe Ferrara owns Atlantis Fantasy World in Santa Cruz, California.
Archie is kind of like the beginning point for the majority of people who've read comics. It's kind of like your rite of passage. You know, as you're introduced into the world of reading and the world of comics and entertainment, you find out about Archie and all of his classmates and how much their normal lives reflect the same thing that happens to all of us.
We here at Morning Edition are following the Archie saga closely and would like to present our interpretation of this momentous occasion. The NPR players bring you Archie Pops the Question. It's 5 years in the future, and Archie and Veronica are in the big city, walking past Spiffany's.
Everything's Archie. Sugar. Oh, honey, honey.
Oh, Archie, you know I can't stand that song. You've been singing that for decades now. Will you ever change your tune?
Hey, Veronica, let's go in. I need your help picking out something for my, mom.
Well, hello. Welcome to Spiffany's.
Actually, Veronica, I'm here to get something for you.
Oh, my! What a beautiful diamond ring.
Veronica, we've known each other for more than 65 years. And by the way, you don't look a day over 16. And I think I'm ready to...
What are you trying to say, Archie?
Veronica, will you...
Marry me?
Uh-huh.
Just at that moment, Betty walks by and sees Archie down on one knee.
Oh, Archie, no!
What will Betty do? What will Veronica say? Will Archie really go through with it? Stay tuned. Well, Betty did what any modern girl would do. She went home and blogged about it weeks ago, and her fans went mad. Editor Victor Gorelick said fans have reacted strongly.
Everybody wanted it to be Betty. I mean, I think they want to read and see what's going to happen. It's a long story. That's all I can tell you.
And just as the love triangle is a literary device as old as storytelling itself, so too is the plot twist. And comic book seller Joe Ferrara doesn't think this is how it will all end.
If I own the company and I know what's made it work for so long, I'm not going to change it so dramatically and kill the golden goose that has been producing the success they've had for so many years.
Apparently about to get very tricky. But I will say, you know, Netta, at Monkey See, we have a comics blogger whose name is Glenn Weldon, who writes for us on Wednesdays about comics. And he also addressed this week. And one of the things that Glenn talked about is that there's this long history in comic books of plot lines that are but are not, and that even within the unreal world of the story, they're not things that really happen, even within that context, Batman dying and Superman dying. And he has a whole wonderful list of these kind of off-the-wall alternate universe storylines that have been hatched. And I think he's pretty confident that this is going to wind up being much ado about nothing and has certainly gotten a lot of attention. But I think he takes the same position as the guy who was making the point that it's unlikely that they're going to, I believe he said, kill the goose that lays the golden egg. This summer, All Things Considered has been talking to artists about their favorite songs of summer. A lot of listeners have written in to say that this song evokes summer more than any other. That's the number one hit song from the summer of 1966, complete with car horns and a jackhammer, Summer in the City by The Lovin' Spoonful. NPR's Melissa Block decided to talk to the group's founder and lead singer, John Sebastian, and see what's his favorite summer song.
And you have picked another number one hit. It predates yours by just a couple of years.
That's right. I picked I Get Around by the Beach Boys.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around.
Me and Felix Pappalardi, the wonderful bass player, he and I were a kind of a duo that accompanied a lot of folk groups. We also had classical backgrounds somewhere or another. And when we heard I Get Around, we both looked at each other and we said, Bach!
Now, wait a second. You're hearing this song from 1964, I Get Around. You're hearing Bach in this music.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, tell me what you're hearing in there.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around.
Right now, we're sort of in familiar surf territory.
Yeah.
All right, so now is a stop break.
First verse, coming after the chorus.
Here's a little, like a C section, kind of. You know, it's wonderful to hear a set of changes. There isn't just a verse and a chorus, that there's something that leads you from one of those to the other. Kind of goes back and gives you the same information again, like in a chorale. And now here we are at the part that everybody can sing along with. It's very much like church music that Bach wrote.
I think I'm starting to hear it the way you are. Although right now I'm back cruising in California. I'm out of
church.
That's
right. I mean, you can't help but sweep your hair back.
So you were listening to this in the summer of 1964. This was the Beach Boys' first number one hit, I think. And
that's right.
And you said, "California, here I come."
Well, we had just come out of this dark New York winter and huddling on Bleecker and McDougal in leather jackets and just feeling like we were Woody Guthrie and all of this stuff. Mm. And now here is this wonderfully folk-free influence. And then when we would get gigs in Los Angeles and you'd rent the car and you'd turn this tune up, you know, that was heaven.
That's it for this week. You can find links to every single story you've heard today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby.
And I'm Linda Holmes.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. Well known, yeah, the bad guys know us and they leave us alone.